Good morning, all. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, but before we get started, I just wanted to tell you the process we're going to go through for the next week. We're going to have an omnibus bill, and so all the bills that we will be talking about will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The omnibus bill will be voted on. We will have it up next Tuesday, and we will get it out next Tuesday night. We have room reserved for night if folks would like to spend the evening with me. I'm glad to have folks spend the evening with me. I hope to have the bill posted on Friday to give folks ample room for amendments or ample time for amendments. We're going to have some bills on Thursday. I am not sure we will be in possession of all the bills, but we will have informational hearings on Thursday if we're not in possession, because some of them will be done Wednesday and Thursday. Any questions, members, about the procedure? No questions? Yes, Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, does that include House File 84? Will that be laid over for possible inclusion? The
yes.
Lash bill? Thank you.
It's the bills today and the bills that we have on Thursday. Yes. All right. With that, we are going to – Representative Hansen isn't here. He had some he's not down here yet. So we're going to start with Representative Faulk, House File 1976. Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have a DE1 amendment before us, and Ms. Taylor actually has a small technical change to incorporate into that. So I would like her to report the technical change. We can incorporate that into the DE1 and then adopt the DE1 amendment.
Okay. First, we need for you to move House File 1976.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1976 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
All right, and we have an amendment in your packet, members. Council?
That the amendment would be to the DE1 amendment that's in your packet. If you go to line 2.13, after prairies, insert and other native species.
We do have a 24-hour rule, but if there aren't any objections, I'm inclined to waive the rule because this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion and there'll be ample time for amendments later. I don't see any objections. All those in favor of the amendment to the amendment, say aye.
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 The amendment to the amendment passes, is adopted. All those in favor of the adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any objection? The amendment has been adopted. Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1976 is the establishment of a terrestrial invasive invasive terrestrial plants and pest center at the University of Minnesota. And the purpose of this is to hopefully have a more proactive approach in dealing with some of the threats that face our state's prairies, forests, wetlands, and agricultural resources. And I know what often has become the issue is that we see a threat facing the state and we have to kind of scramble to go in and get together a response to it. And oftentimes we're having to go in and do a lot of work very quickly, whereas if we can go and have the people and the infrastructure in place to go and make that task more proactive, I think we'll be better equipped to deal with some of these threats that face our state's significant resources. The The center, as it, I'll just refer to it, it would be a collaboration between the College of Food and Agricultural Natural Resources Science in coordination with the College of Biological Sciences. And we're trying to bring together folks with different experiences across the following departments are listed in the bill, but I'll just go through them. Entomology, plant pathology, forest resources, horticultural science, fisheries, wildlife and conservation biology, agronomy and plant genetics, plant biology, and ecology, evolution, and behavior. And in addition, across those different departments, we'd also like to fully utilize the resources we have around the state, including the Cloquet Forestry Center, North Central Research and Outreach Center, Northwest Research and Outreach Center, Southern Research and Outreach Center, Southwest Research and Outreach Center, West Central Research and Outreach Center, Rosemont Research and Outreach Center, and the Horticultural Research Center, and the Sand Plain Research Center. And so we really want to bring together a broad group of people from across the state to go and best develop methods and practices to go and control both invasive species and kind of what I deem to be agricultural weeds. In addition to focusing on that aspect, we want to make sure we also focus on pests and pathogens and the threat that they also pose to our state's resources. One of the tasks the center will be designated to create is a prioritized list of pest and plant species that threaten our state's prairies, forests, wetlands, and agricultural resources. And that will help us to go and better determine which things need immediate attention and perhaps immediate funding as projects are moving through processes like the LCCMR requests. After creating that prioritized list, the center will also be focused on research on the species on the prioritized list, developing new control methods, including biocontrols, and looking at integrated pest management tools, focusing on prevention, and then looking at the consequences that some of those management techniques may have on our native prairies, pollinators, water resources, and other native species. And lastly, we want this center to report back to us by the 15th of January to help us formulate the response that, and the decisions that we have to make in the legislative process as to best deal with these threats. With me, I have Dr. Brian Burr. I believe you're serving as interim dean and for the College of Agricultural Food. Or I'll let you. I'll get the acronym wrong, but I'll give it over. Turn it over to him.
Dr. Burr, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Falk, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me today, and thank you for introducing this bill related to terrestrial invasive species. I brought with me Professor William Hutchison, who's seated behind me. He's the head of entomology. I'm an economist. I bring a science expert with me whenever I have the opportunity to talk about. He works in the area of insect invasive species. And what I thought I would do is just give a brief overview of how the University of Minnesota would approach this, starting with what the impacts of invasives are. There's some slides up here that I consider the rogues gallery of invasives in Minnesota and how broadly they impact us. Overall, economically, the impacts of invasive species across the U.S., looking at published research, is about $134 billion across the country. In Minnesota, we estimate there's about $3 billion, and that's probably light, given that it cuts across not only, you know, private sector economic impacts, but a lot of public sector impacts and ecosystem services, water clarity, water use issues. It affects plant life. It affects forestry. Very cross-cutting issues related to invasive species. And that's one of the aspects that I think CFANS, which is the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, helps bring to this. We have a broad, diverse faculty and engagement to do that. Many of these species, as you look at them, affect not only rural habitat, whether it's forestry, wetlands, farming. It also affects our urban landscape when you think of emerald ash borers, for example, that impact the canopy in urban areas. So very broad and diverse effects. As also you see the slide, you'll see, which affects how we approach this, that some of these are pathogens, microbial infections, whether it's viral or bacterial. Infections like oak wilt, for example, includes insects, which brings together entomology. It includes weeds, where we get into agronomy, plant sciences, and so on. We envision putting the center together really with the principle that Representative Falk talked about of identifying a net impact of invasives. As you can tell from these slides, there's many, many different types of species requiring many different mechanisms of control, or identification and management. And so we'd start off with is trying to get at, you know, what is our potential to have the most impact on these, whether that's through control or prevention. You know, where is it economically that they have the most impact? And start to be able to identify which of these do we address first to be able to effectively use those resources and move them forward. We'd also be, of course, looking at, there is a designated list of invasive species that's been identified through the DNR and Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We'd be using that as a potential list to look at where should we invest and make efforts in addressing these species. We would approach this not only from a control perspective, but one of the aspects is before things move into the state, are there ways to prevent their introduction to start with? Along with early detection, if they do arrive, to be able to intervene when the scope is not that large, where you can have more localized, more effective interactions. And then, of course, looking at those endemic issues that we have that are widely dispersed in the state and trying to, you know, hopefully eliminate or eradicate, but, of course, also perhaps trying to control and localize those impacts so they don't spread as rapidly. So a multi-pronged approach, dependent upon what the species is, what we think the impact is we can have. We'd certainly be looking at biocontrol methods, an important way of looking at this, integrated pest management, and other technologies that might come into play. So very broadly looking at methods we might get at controlling invasive species. We're certainly aware, if you've watched the bee colony collapse issues that are emerging across the country, we're aware of non-target effects of various control mechanisms. So we'd be looking at ways we control these that we'd like to, you know, minimize the impacts on other native species, whether it's plants, whether it's insects, or whatever those other natives might be. So really looking carefully at how do we control those non-target impacts. And, of course, as CFANS often does, we already have strong relationships with Minnesota Department of Ag, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and looking at building across state agencies and other organizations that are also working to affect the invasive species. One of the things that's not in the bill that we would likely look towards, Minnesota does have an extension service, and one of the aspects we see of invasives is often, you know, citizens' activities in both identifying where they are. It's oftentimes somebody out in the field that finds a species and reports that in. So if you look at DNR's websites or Department of Ag's websites, they have reporting services. And then oftentimes it's citizens also acting in control and elimination. So that is something that we have the capacity to do that's certainly not part of the bill. We would be looking at bringing that to bear as well on some of these issues. I alluded to several times our capacity, and Representative Falk read through the list of programs. And one of the really interesting things for CFANS is we do have existing researchers in entomology, plant pathology, forest resources, horticulture, applied economics, fisheries, wildlife, agronomy, and bioengineering that are engaging in some of these activities already. What this bill really does for us is looking at bringing a more concerted, coordinated effort across those, where we look at, for example, bioengineering is looking at early detection, monitoring techniques to see where invasive species are, you know, tying that into with, for example, entomology and looking at the spotted wing Drosophila. One of those things that, if you're thinking of invasives, is not a particularly appetizing version of invasives. It comes into soft-skinned fruits, black or blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, the grape industry. The larvae hatch in those, and so the test that Dr. Hutchison talks about is putting the berries on your shelf for a day, and if you have maggots on your countertop, there are spotted Drosophila larvae there. So some of these things in crossing, then, how do we identify where those are spreading to? Might rely on some of the monitoring techniques from bioengineering, for example. So being able to address those in a concerted way is really a highlight of this. Oftentimes, our faculty are working on them, but they're fairly targeted, specific projects. This would help to tie those together. Finally, just to talk a little bit about the research outreach centers. As you look at these species, you find they affect many different habitats, from agricultural zones in the southern part of Minnesota to forestry in the northern part of Minnesota, to the wetlands, to prairies. And so one of the things our research outreach centers provide us is we are present across the state in those. We have researchers on hand there. Grand Rapids Cloquet Center is already looking at forest impacts of emerald ash borer and other issues. Grand Rapids is looking at some of the fruit production impacts of these. So we're able to draw across these diverse landscapes to address more broadly those impacts. Within the university, just from the standpoint of structuring this into the university, we would look at this as being a college-wide and across college with College of Biological Sciences program to draw across these disciplines. In many cases, like aquatic invasive species, fairly focused on wildlife conservation biology. In this case, because we draw across these disciplines, we'd have it as a college-level center. And the idea of that is to be able to engage more broadly across disciplines where there are implications for how we control or address some of the invasive species issues. We would view there as being a faculty research leader on this to coordinate activities. That would be someone who could overarch across these. And they would report ideally directly to the dean of the college so that we could coordinate efforts and be more effective in scaling those up. Because we have quite a few of the faculty resources there that are occurring already, we would really like to focus on graduate research assistants and postdocs, which builds into workforce development around these issues. That as we visit, in fact, I visit with Commissioner Landwehr with DNR, we talk frequently about workforce development in these areas, that we simply don't have the students coming out or enough students coming out to address the diversity of issues out there. And in bringing grad students into these research projects helps move us into building that capacity to address these more broadly across agencies and so on as they're trained in these areas. So with that, I'll just reiterate that the college is very supportive of this. We believe we have the capacity to do the research. We have faculty. I've met with department heads across each of these departments in meetings. We've discussed our abilities to address these. They're excited about the prospects of working on these important issues. They're working on them already. So we have grad student support. The ROCs are supportive of the proposals. And we're collaborating already with several NGOs, state departments, and certainly LCCMR on these proposals. And thank the House of Representatives for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate that support. So thank you. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Questions, members? I think we have some folks in the audience who would like to testify too, but questions for members before that? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Falk, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know we spoke out in the parking ramp, and we had some individuals that had some concerns initially that it was too restrictive. And with the DE amendment, I think it addresses those concerns. So I thank you for that as well. And to Dean Boer, if President Kaler's watching, hopefully it won't be interim dean. If he's, I know this is televised, I would just like to go on record that you have my support. And I think that, many people's support to be named dean. We're talking about invasive species. Could you comment a little bit about the university and what we're doing on emerging diseases? Any research around that, or what research is taking place on emerging diseases?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton. Thanks for your question. Thank you for your support. I appreciate that as well. And you're talking about emerging diseases, animal diseases, plant diseases, and so on.
Yes, and Madam Chair, and just to clarify, and because I agree with Representative Falk, we need to do this. And I asked a question to an individual who is in agriculture who's passed away. I said, "What's the biggest threat to agriculture?" And it wasn't price, it wasn't markets. He said, "Emerging diseases." Right. And so I know we need to continue investing in research. And this bill that Representative Falk is bringing forward will do that on the invasive species. I just want to know: are we doing enough to address emerging diseases with the university, or do we need to do something additional with that as well?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton. Yes, we are, and we're doing quite a broad array of that, both in animals and plants. So with invasive species, starting with plants, for example, we have biosecure level 2 and biosecure level 3 laboratories at the University of Minnesota that can also address, actually, insects and other pathogens that allow us to identify and overwinter pathogens that often aren't active. So we have a unique comparative advantage at the University of Minnesota in dealing with, for example, plant disease, and that includes soybean rust. We're looking at UD99 fungal infections in cropping systems and so on. And then the veterinary lab, of course, the University of Minnesota's veterinary diagnostic lab. And so recently, and as I look at my background is often working with animals as well as plants, as we look in the state of Minnesota now and across the country, PEDV is a disease that occurs in swine. And the veterinary lab here at the University of Minnesota has been very active in doing research on PEDV. And I think this also raises the point that as we look at the emergence of changes in climate patterns in the U.S., whether it's variability and so on, what we're starting to see is emergent diseases, as you suggested, Representative Hamilton, coming in both animals as well as plants, the disease we might not have had. And soybean rust is one of those that coming up on wind currents from thunderstorms and with more humid, more intense rainfalls presents a pattern where that becomes more emergent. And we're seeing that with other diseases of forests and so on, too. The boreal forests in northern Minnesota are impacted by pathogens that we wouldn't have seen maybe 20, 30 years ago. And so we're going to see more and more of these emergent, particularly pathogens, some of the, you know, we have emerald ash borer, some of the insects that wouldn't necessarily survive in this zone without some changes in whether it's variability or weather patterns. And so what we expect to see is more and more emergent of things that wouldn't necessarily have been in Minnesota. We were naturally protected. Dr. Hutchinson, for example, has talked about the overwintering capabilities of things like emerald ash borer. This deep winter has an impact on what affects us. So we see this as not only being affecting those that are here, but we need to be more vigilant because we're going to see increases in those emerge, I think, as we go through time and to be able to address those. And I think we're well positioned across both animals and plants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to committee. Interim Dean Burr, glad to see you here this morning. My first question has to do with the Aquatic Invasive Species Center we've already set up. I noticed there we have pictures of some aquatic plants in your presentation. How do you see the two centers, if this goes into law, how do you see the two centers interacting?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, thank you for that question, too. We do see this as a broader strategy within the college now emerging. Eventually, as we move, AIS right now, Aquatic Invasive Species, is a standalone center. It's primarily managed out of the Fisheries, Wildlife, Conservation, Biology Department, and it is focused specifically on aquatic invasives, so Asian carp, European carp, zebra mussels, and so on. That what we would see happening with this one coming in is to create a more integrated invasive species. So, for example, with the carp, they affect both the plant life as well as the plankton. Zebra mussels are affecting native mussels. So we do cross in some ways with aquatic plants, and here we have common reed as something that's an issue in our wetlands and water systems. So we would see this emerging too as a cross-collegiate, and including CBS, for example, working on bioremediation and some of the containment issues with microbials to turn those into an aquatic invasives, perhaps institute, but a more high-level version. Within the college as that moves along. So we see it as compatible with that and helping to bring some of the support infrastructure to that as well.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Now, much of the thing, many of the things you've outlined in your report are activities that are already going on at the university. How do you see this legislation changing, change the focus of your work or just add a new perspective or better coordination, because you do much of this work already.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, we do some of that work, and as I visit about a little bit, oftentimes those are specific research projects. For example, an RFP comes out to address spotted wing Drosophila, and so that would go, for example, to the Department of Entomology. They would work specifically on that issue. At the same time, you know, that might, if, as they're working with other researchers, it might lead to a cooperative project with bio-based product engineering. There could be elements of biocontrol that go over into microbial sciences, trying to find ways to control that, but it's not necessarily a part of that proposal. So first we'd be always looking towards, as part of this underlying, how do we do this net impact, is trying to coordinate across those to say, where are those pieces where we have the most ability to address those two or three issues, to control, identify, and address the issue. And so it would bring that coordination that oftentimes, you know, as we get individual projects, they don't coordinate as well. And then the hope would be, you know, in building, particularly with grad students, we're building some of the capacity to be able to do these things as well. And the third piece is working across state agencies. We've had a strong relationship working with them, and this helps us to bring some capacity to engage them as well. So I think there are many dimensions to how this helps to coordinate those activities and expand them and be more effective.
Thank you. Just one more question, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. I congratulate Representative Falk for bringing agriculture into this mix. I think that's a good idea. But Interim Dean Burr, do you see any potential for conflict down the road between, let's say, the commercial side of this and the native side of this?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I hadn't thought about that much. If there are commercial, you know, I could see an element where with, methods of control, for example, and chemical sides, whether it's resistance issues and so on, there being possibilities. But ultimately, in invasive species side of this, most of this are, if you're looking at agriculture, of course, the weeds, the pests of livestock and so on, are elements that have economic impacts across that board. As we look at this, we're looking at, of course, as how do we create the science that addresses the issues that are here. So that was, Madam Chair, would it be okay if Professor Hutchinson?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Please put your name in for the record and
yes,
welcome.
My name is Bill Hutchison, Professor of Entomology and Department Head in CFANS for Entomology, and appreciate the opportunity to assist Brian Burr here today as well. Just quickly, I think there are many areas with our invasives that there's actually a lot of crossover between the natural systems that we work with and agriculture. And so buckthorn, which is recently shown here, common buckthorn, just continues to be probably one of the poster childs for the worst case invasive that we can think about. If you've got any of this in your own yards, it's very difficult to deal with. One of the interesting things with spotted wing Drosophila is just one example, is that we have some preliminary data to show that the females can also oviposit in some of the buckthorn berries, and thus there's a possibility of either overwintering in the berries, being further dispersed by the berries as they fall, etc. So that's an example where, you know, these insects don't necessarily see the boundaries that we often look at, where they can use these natural systems as reservoirs, in essence, or alternate hosts as reservoirs to then, in the spring and during the growing season, further infect some of our agricultural crops. So from our perspective, I think for many of these pests and or pathogens, we can see a crossover. And really not, you know, that just adds to the fact that we need to study both systems in concert as part of these interdisciplinary efforts. So if that helps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I said it was my last question, but we have a new testifier, so.
Pardon?
We have a new testifier, so. I guess I'm more interested.
Representative Torkelson, we have reserved this room for this evening, too. And if we do not finish these three bills this morning, we will do them this evening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know how much I like spending time with you.
So. I know. So I just wanted to remind you that you had the opportunity.
I guess I'm curious a little bit about control methods that we might use for these invasive pests and how they might affect the commercial side of things differently than they might affect the natural side of things, and how there might be conflicts there, and how would this college or research center deal with priorities?
Right, great question. And, the term proactive was used earlier in introducing this bill, and I think that's really the key as part of the risk assessment. You really have to go with the opportunities for biological control for certain pests where we have those, and sometimes in the commercial ag settings with spotted wing Drosophila, for example. One of the worst case invasives that I've dealt with in my career, and we had, so when that hit in August of 2012, we had growers that were just moving into the peak raspberry harvest season. We didn't have time. It hit so fast and so drastically throughout the state. It was not a slow-moving insect pest. It so quickly that we had to quickly develop control guidelines which required the use of traditional insecticides. We do have some organic certified insecticides. But this is just probably a worst-case example where when we don't have the funding up front to really develop a true proactive risk assessment, communicate to the stakeholders, in this case the growers, organic and conventional growers, to an audience that for 30 years has really not had to use insecticides that much. It was a huge culture shift. It was a huge educational challenge. And so in settings like that where you're dealing with high cash crops, high value crops, and they're looking, and growers were literally going out of business by mid-September or just discontinuing their pick-your-own operations for that fall. You know, that's a situation where we have to act quickly. We have to look at what has worked in other states, Michigan State, North Carolina in this case. We had very little data to go on. So in those commercial ag settings, we don't always have the luxury of a 4 to 5 year biological control project. That in essence for agriculture is still our long-term goal. Great way to go. It's worked great for alfalfa weevil and alfalfa 20 years ago. That is still an effective program in most areas of the state. So it's definitely the best long-term way to go in terms of reducing pesticide loads in the environment, reducing costs to the growers, and long-term control. But it depends on the pest. It's sort of a case-by-case basis, if that helps.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions right now, so I would ask. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I did as long as Dr. Hutchinson's there. Dr. Hutchinson, I'm curious. On the second page of the handout we were given, the earthworm is on there, but Norway maple is on there. I'm curious. I'm not sure who picked that species to be on that slide. I'm just curious if you could expand on, or maybe you're not. Is it your handout, Dr. Hutchinson?
That I did not have a lot of personal input on the handout from Brian Burr's office, but the earthworm, and briefly, all I can really refer to or address as the earthworm question is just being very disruptive.
No, I'm okay with the earthworm.
Forest floor ecology, but you mentioned the Norway maple.
Yeah, I'm just surprised. We've got a lot of species that are much more invasive than Norway maple. I'm surprised to see that species on this.
Right.
And that the emphasis
out,
there.
You know, great question. That's outside my area of expertise.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like, if the university could get back to the chair on the selection of that species, I'm surprised at that.
But Brian might be able to.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that's on, so it is listed as one of the invasive species in Minnesota, and the reason for it is oftentimes you have plants that are brought into the state, tree woody plants, so this is kind of a horticultural piece. Woody plant. It was meant to be representative of woody plants coming in that aren't native to the state that can crowd out native species of plants. And so for the horticulture industry, the question is often, it raises the question of human intermediation, the role that we have and as we move plants and also species into the state. It wasn't meant to identify any particular plant or any particular species.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just expand, there's a number of species that would have been better suited to be in this picture than Norway maple. Norway maple and its cultivars play an important role in our urban forestry. That specifically is on this slide, and I'm thinking I can think of a number of tree species that would be better to be there. And I'm not aware of that being on the invasive species list in itself. I mean, amber maple would have been a lot better to be there, and they're both still planted today in this state than this one. I can just think of many more better than this one. I'm surprised at its selection. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I had a question for the other doctor, if we could play musical chairs again and ask him a question. A lot of talk in this committee during the session about pollinators and the effects of spraying insecticides and such. And one of the things we talked about was spraying soybeans for aphids, for example. We'd just like to ask if the university is doing any research on coming up with a biological control through the seed or whatever else to hopefully that we could get away from spraying soybeans for aphids. It would help our pollinators as well.
Okay. Thank you for the question, Madam Chair and committee member. Yes, so we've been dealing with the soybean aphid since about 2000 when we first discovered it in Minnesota, and that's an example of a relatively slow-moving invasive that took 3 years plus or minus to make it across the state. And so most of the insecticide load in soybean still is directed at that pest. I should say we also have brown marmorated stink bug in the state, another invasive that's on its way. That is here, I should say, but it's just now building up to larger numbers. So that said, that is a key part of our educational extension outreach effort with growers, is to continue to emphasize only spray as needed based on an economic threshold value of approximately 250 aphids per plant that was developed in our department and with other states participating. That said, just using that guideline, that decision point alone can have a, greatly reduced insecticide use. So, or risk-averse growers might want to spray 3 to 4 times in an extreme year in Minnesota for this one pest. Many years, many fields, only one spray is really needed if you follow that guideline. So, or if growers follow those guidelines, we work with crop consultants as well, who often manage 10,000 acres each in many growers. So, that said, also the time of day. So let's just say, yes, we do need to spray. So time of day plays a huge role. If you can spray later in the evening after honeybees or other bees are not foraging, that's another way to protect bees. What we really need more data on that topic is what exactly is the both native bumblebee and honeybee foraging behavior in a crop like soybeans. Soybean flowers are not the most attractive flowers, at least to honeybee. And Iowa State, there's some data now coming out of Iowa. We need more data like this from Minnesota. But basically, the preliminary data out of Iowa is that by far the dominant bee species in soybean are all the native bumblebees. Many species of either ground nesting bumblebees or others, such that honeybee is probably less than 1% of the total bee diversity that's in that crop, and the same goes for corn, just a side note. So, part of that is a huge risk assessment on in terms of neonic seed treatment exposure to bees through the flowers, systemically through the plant, that might accrue and accumulate in the nectar of those flowers. Part of it is the direct, probably the biggest risk in soybean right now would be the direct foliar applications for soybean aphid or some of the other pests. So that's what we are focusing on. Bob Cook is our soybean entomologist who's leading that effort as well. So I hope that answers your question.
That is one of the issues we have been talking about, and obviously native bumblebees are in great decline too. Mm-hmm. So as that's been part of our conversation here. Representative Keel, did you have a question? Okay. Dr. Zemeta would like to testify. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Zemeta. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. Council was created by the Sustainable Forest Resources Act of 1995. Council includes 17 diverse interests, 16 appointed by the governor, one by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Core mission of the council is to advise the governor and legislature as well as public agencies on sustainable forest policies and practices. Forest Resources Council has had a long-standing interest in the issue of terrestrial invasive species. The 2007 legislature directed the council to create a Forest Protection Plan Task Force. It was charged with developing a plan to prepare the state for early detection of and appropriate response to invasive forest pests and public education about invasive pests that threaten our forests across the state. Two key findings from that task force's 2008 report to the legislature included, number one, because of global trade and increased travel, new pests threaten the health and survival of many tree and other forest species in rural, suburban, and urban areas across Minnesota. Second, failure to detect and eradicate invasive forest pests costs hundreds of millions of dollars. Of the $3+ billion impacts that Dr. Burr estimated across all types of land in Minnesota in his written remarks that he handed out to you in your packets. These impacts cause serious harm to Minnesota's environment and economy, including the $6 to $7 billion forest products economy, the $9 billion tourism economy, and the even larger agricultural economy. Since 2012, the impact of terrestrial invasive species on forest health has been one of my council's top forest policy issues. Council's been working with the University of Minnesota, the DNR, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and relevant federal agencies to heighten awareness and understanding of economic and ecological impacts of these species. My council supports the proposed center for the following four reasons. One, the center would serve as a lead role, would serve a lead role in terrestrial invasive species research and education across not only forest lands, but across farmlands, wetlands, and prairies. Forests are interspersed with these other types of land across the state. This center could play a critical integrative role that no single institution is filling today, to the detriment of both our economy and our environment. CFANS and the proposed center are uniquely suited to fill this integrative role. Second, the proposed Terrestrial Plants and Pests Research Center would be a major step toward improving our collective understanding of which terrestrial invasive species in Minnesota are the most important to control and what the most effective control strategies may be. Some species are not amenable to control, and we can spend a lot of money and waste a lot of money trying to control them when it's not going to work. Other species we may not be spending enough money on, and this across sectors, this would be a great opportunity to look across agriculture, forestry, and other sectors at the needs for controlling different invasive species and setting research priorities accordingly. Prospective long-term savings resulting from this research, very hard to predict, but they could well be in the tens of millions of dollars or even more. Third, the center would serve as a clearinghouse for research-based information and educational programs on terrestrial invasive species and the risks their establishment and management pose, not only to forests, but to farmlands, wetlands, prairies, and other ecosystems. No such information clearinghouse currently exists. Once again, CFANS and the proposed center would be uniquely suited to fill this role. And finally, a significant share of the center's funding would be directed toward graduate student and postdoctoral assistantships. As invasive species experts in state and federal agencies in the private sector retire, folks like me and my generation, this center would provide well-trained people to replace them. There are currently not enough well-trained people to address either industry's needs or public agencies' needs in this area. I've been privileged to work in Minnesota state government for over 32 years, and some of the finest colleagues I have are in this area of forest health and in the Department of Agriculture as well. These folks are going to retire in droves over the next 5+ years, and we need well-educated folks coming behind them to replace them to address this enormous challenge that our state faces. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions for members? I don't see any. Is there anybody in the public who would like to weigh in with a word or two? I don't see any questions from the public. Representative Falk? I'm sorry. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll reserve my comments and let Representative McNamara, we've been talking, address it. Okay.
Madam Chair, I think we had both had the same question. It's for Representative Falk. How much of the committee's $15 million are you hoping to get in this bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. I'm hoping to get a sizable amount of money, and part of that negotiation is going to continue to be ongoing with Chair Wagenius. So if you want to be helpful in helping me arm wrestle some more money for this, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Falk, is it your intention to just fund it over the next year, the rest of this biennium, or are you trying to lock up some money? There's talk in about a 10-year plan and so many million dollars in the university's presentation. How much are you hoping to get?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, as this is drifted here, drafted. Can't speak. If you look at the very last line, it says the appropriation is available until June 30th, 2025. So we're trying to give ample time, but I know that there's a lot of need out there, and we have pretty limited resources, and so we're trying to get as much money for this to get it up and running. Although I think part of what we're establishing here is a framework, and as we have this prioritized list, then as those who serve on like LCCMR, they'll be able to go and look at that list and understand which are the threats that are probably have the greatest potential for economic impact to our state, and we need to look at as quickly as possible. And so having that list is going to help us going down the road be able to determine what needs to get prioritized as far as funding goes, whether it's through general fund appropriation, whether it's through LCCMR, or it could be some other form of appropriation.
So, Madam Chair, if I could just ask, so are you hoping to get at least $5
million? Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I think that would be a very nice number. I think, you know, perhaps some of these questions might be better directed to the Chair and what her purview is, but I'm going to argue for as much funding for this center as possible.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Falk, as a co-author of your bill, that's what I wanted to hear, that you're working hard, because Representative Wagenius has got to value all the different people that are trying to grab some of that $15 million, and I just want you to advocate real hard for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would like to say, in just closing comments, too, I do appreciate the work of Dr. Burr and Representative Wagenius has been good to go and facilitate some of these conversations. And I do think that this is a unique opportunity to go and span across a whole number of areas that oftentimes you don't think of coming together, but this is a great opportunity to bring those groups together. And I do appreciate the work that's gone into this. So thank you, members.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to give it a try here. Representative Falk was... Is this a part of the governor's recommendations as well? Have you had conversations with the governor's staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, you know, there's, I can't remember the exact passage in Mason's, but I'm a kind of a believer in the fact that you don't reference the executive body when you're talking about the legislative process. But I do not believe this is part of the governor's recommendations, but that's the whole purpose of why we have a legislative body, is to go and debate and bring forward additional ideas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the Senate, is this moving there as well? Or there again, we're kind of, maybe we'll have some offline conversations. I do have one question for Interim Director Burr, please.
Senator Saxfog is the senator who's carrying the bill.
Interim Director Burr, thank you for being here. You said that extension was not a part of this proposal, this bill.
Right.
Would you care to elaborate on that for me, please, why it's not?
Madam Chair, Representative, this was intended to be a research bill primarily at this point, to try and focus on getting a handle on how we might address the invasive species issue. As that moves along, we would consider putting in proposals for extension through LCCMR or the research proposals that are out there to extend this activity.
Madam Chair, if I could comment to that too. Exactly what Dr. Burr stated. This is a research bill. We already have a number of delivery mechanisms, but until we can actually deliver a product, we actually have to go and figure out what works first. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we focus solely on the research aspect of it.
Representative Fabian, I would suggest, too, that you look at lines 2.15 to 2.20 in the bill. We are asking for additional input as we get started with this bill. So, members, I do not see any other questions. Representative Falk renews his motion that House File 2101 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. If I said that wrong, it's 1976. Thank you to the testifiers. Thank you, Representative Paul. Next on the agenda is Representative Lesh, and I move that House File 84 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill. And we welcome Representative Lesh. And in this case, the bill has been through a policy committee, and we are going to be talking about the finances of the bill. Representative Lesh, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Members, House File 84 represents a long, slow slog of about 7 or 8 years of working on this issue. In fact, I don't think there's another bill in my 12 years of the legislature that I've worked on longer with more input from more parties. I see people sitting around the table here who have worked on other versions or have had a lot of input into this one. A lot of people around this body have worked on this bill or versions of it. This one now represents a product of stakeholders' input on both sides and is, I think, a version that folks are going to be happy with in general. It doesn't achieve completely what either side wants independently, but it strikes a good balance, which is supposed to be the product of what we do up here at the legislature. Members, Minnesota is among the top producers of puppies in the United States, with some of the largest kennels producing hundreds and even over 1,000 litters. Kittens are also mass-produced in Minnesota. The state of the existence of these animals in these cages has been reflected in news reports, both in the newspaper and on the news, that most of us don't want to watch. And that is what this bill is intended to address, because until it's addressed, we're going to continually have to be subjected to these kinds of tragedies that happen in the dark corners of our state, which at this point can only be exposed on a report-based system, which is clearly inadequate. The USDA also licenses approximately 33 producers in Minnesota that sell to pet shops, but for all those producers of litters who sell to you in the parking lot of the Home Depot or on Craigslist or across the internet, they all are completely uninspected, and that's where generally we get the news reports of these tragedies occurring. This bill is intended to create a regulatory framework that can help to address this. There are some local units of government that also have their own laws, but there is no individual statewide inspection system. So this bill intends to create that. That's where the fiscal note comes from. I'm not sure if, Madam Chair, if it was your intention to have testifiers on this or if it was just our, because we were looking at laying it over in the finance portion of the bill, if we were just going to go to questions for those individuals.
I think we want to hear if there are questions about the financing, and that would be where I would welcome questions. There may not be any either, so that's because a lot of people have already heard this bill once. Are there questions, Representative Hamilton?
Madam Chair, I do have a question about the financing. Then also, we do have an A14 amendment as well. So, okay. First of all, on the financing, I know I spoke to the Board of Animal Health, and they said that it's absolutely critical that the financing is sufficient in order to administer this, Madam Chair. And so I guess I just want to make sure that we're on record that we do have the adequate funding that goes along with this bill to make sure that the Board of Animal Health is prepared, if you will, to administer this.
Representative Blood.
Thank you. That is my understanding and expectation as well, Madam Chair. So because this bill and the product of it, and as Representative Hamilton correctly pointed out, we even have an amendment here today, the A14 amendment, which is intended to address any lingering concerns, because we've remained willing to work with folks and partners all the way up to today and hereafter to address any concerns. But the A14 encompasses those concerns, and it's our expectation, obviously, that the financing be there to properly make sure that the law is followed. So I'd ask a member, since Representative Hamilton brought it up, and also we have a oral amendment. I have an oral amendment if the chair would consider it. This is the same language that was passed in the Senate the other day, so it's intended to be reflected in the Senate. And It includes on line 6.33 under investigations. Humane agent appointed under section 34301 is made aware of a, and it would be included, an alleged violation under this chapter or chapter. And that same word alleged would be added before the word violation on line 7.1.
Members, we do have a 24-hour rule. This seems very technical to me, and I would waive the rule if members would agree to that, and I would move the amendment. It makes sense to me. It's clarifying language is what it is. I don't see any objections. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any nays? That amendment is adopted.
And then the only other item, Madam Chair, is the A14 amendment, as mentioned by Representative Hamilton.
And whose amendment is this?
Your Honor, this would be an author's amendment, but it's the product of compromise between the stakeholders.
Okay. So I will move the A14 amendment. And would you like to explain it to folks?
Well, Madam Chair, if I could, because it was gone through between the stakeholders, if I could have, Mr. Clark, do you want to come down? It incorporates several different items, and just to make sure that I have it all correct, I'd rather have Mr. Clark explain it, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
That would be fine. Mr. Clark, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Essentially, line 1.2 through 1.4 identifies which sections of 343 and 346 would be applicable. The other 1.8 through 1.10, it just adds language that is found later in the bill, just makes the bill consistent. And line 1.5 makes it clear that petty misdemeanors are not included when somebody would be when their license would be considered. And Madam Chair, this is essentially a compromise, as Representative Lesch mentioned, between the stakeholders. I know Representative Hamilton and Representative Anderson were part of these discussions, and hopefully that clarifies the amendment.
Just as an overall, Madam Chair, some of the representatives of breeders were concerned that some of the nuances could hook them in ways that they hadn't anticipated, and so this was clarifying language to establish that was not our intent.
I think that's clear, and I don't see any questions. All those in favor of the A14 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any objection? Okay, that amendment is adopted. I am not seeing any questions from members. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify strictly about the finances of this bill? This is a finance committee. I don't see any other members of the public. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesch. And, and Madam Chair, it's my understanding that this is being held over for possible inclusion in a larger bill.
That's true.
Correct? Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, we have an agreement, when we were in the last committee, that if there was any provisions that were removed from this bill that are extremely important to the pet breeders, whether it's the data privacy and some of the others, if any of those were removed, or if this bill would morph into anything other than what the intent is of the author and all the stakeholders, in addition to or going beyond the scope of what it says right here with pet breeders, dogs, and cats, that Representative Lesch said that this would then again no longer have his support and be pulled. And Madam Chair, I'm just there's been a lot of work that's gone into this, and so I guess I'm now looking at you as the author, that if you would provide us with that same commitment as well.
If this bill is included in the omnibus bill, it will be included as is with the fiscal note that we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Three people signed up to testify. If they would like to speak about the finances, they're welcome to do so. We're going to take not a lot of time on that, but you may testify for a moment or two. Elaine Hansen would be first, Valerie LeBlue, and then Quinn Cheney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Elaine Hansen. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Dog Clubs and the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. As most of you from other committees know, we are not supporting this bill. We do have some concerns that are very specific to the finances, however. This bill appropriates $310,000 in the coming year and then escalates up to something like $417,000. The three-year total is over $1 million, and that is to monitor the activities of an unknown number of pet breeders. The fiscal note estimates that there are 475 such breeders. Data from other states would indicate that this is most likely a gross inflation of the number of people to be regulated. Texas estimated 1,000 and has 36 licensed. Wisconsin estimated hundreds and a few dozens were licensed. Tennessee estimated 500 and in 3 years' time 20 were found and licensed. But it's not just that number that makes Tennessee of interest. It's the fact that they incorporated a sunset clause into their bill. It expires in June 2014, and the bill to extend the deadline has failed in both chambers. The state of Tennessee is no longer spending in excess of $1 million every couple years to monitor a handful of cat and dog breeders. If this bill passes, I would ask that it be with an amendment to include a sunset clause to see whether in 2 or 3 years' time this bill will, in fact, reduce animal cruelty, will find the miscreants among pet breeders and deal with them appropriately, will reduce consumer complaints about getting sick puppies over the internet or any other way, and also that it will fulfill its promise to make pet breeders somehow more responsible, more ethical, more competent. I'm not sure what it would be that needs to be improved because of the pet breeders that I know. All of them already are those things.
Thank you. Valerie LeBlue.
My name is Valerie LeBeau, and I am a pet breeder in the state of Minnesota. I operate Tails of Gold, where I breed well-bred golden retrievers that are absolutely gorgeous and beautiful. I am here to talk about the financial aspects of this bill as well, and I have asked the page to pass out an economic impact study that shows how bills like this have affected actually the state of Missouri in this case. My first point is that there is a negative return on investment for the state of Minnesota with this bill, both in the area of jobs and revenue. Jobs are going to be lost in your district, in every one of your districts, if this bill passes. Breeders like myself, I'm a serious hobby breeder, rarely operate at a profit. When more government regulation and licensing fees are added onto us, many of us are going to go out of business or have to reduce our sizes significantly. But it's not only the breeders that are going to lose their jobs. The economic impact study that I've passed around and also some of the other studies they've done in Missouri in particular shows that not only breeders are losing their jobs, but also because of the scarcity of well-bred pets and the scarcity of breeders, what happens is it affects the pet food industry. It affects feed stores, veterinarians, groomers, boarders, and more.
As we're talking about the fiscal impact, we're talking about this and not the broad implications of that was done in policy committee. So we are talking about our consolidated fiscal note as we talk about our finances.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that it will have a negative return for Minnesotans in the area of jobs and revenue, and that is definitely a financial aspect. The other reason that this, and the second, my second point is that it's a poor use of funds because it only imposes these regulations on a small segment of the pet industry and not a larger segment of the pet industry. And this is really a David and Goliath story.
We are talking about the fiscal note right now. This is a finance committee, and the testimony you're giving is the appropriate was had in the policy committee. So if you could wrap it up.
I don't think that this argument was made in the policy committee because
it's not the argument. We're talking about the fiscal note here. Did they capture the right numbers in the fiscal note?
Well, and I think that Elaine spoke to that in that there's going to be, you're going to find that there are probably many fewer breeders that are involved, okay? But the amount of funding that is being appropriated if you go ahead and pass this, okay, is enough to fund the entire pet industry, including the rescues and shelters that have many more resources and assets and are the ones that are supporting this bill and to attack breeders to put them out of business and out of competition. The Animal Humane Society, who has testified on this in many committee hearings, okay, they have got over $20 million in assets and over $12 million in.
Excuse me, you're going to have to wrap this up. I am watching the clock, and I want to be respectful to anyone who wants to testify about the fiscal note that we have. To this bill. That is our job here, and if you would limit your comments to the fiscal note, I would appreciate it.
Well, I think that it does have to do with the fiscal note when we're talking about that there is enough money here to cover the entire pet industry, and it's not fair to just cover one small segment of it, especially since other parts of Minnesota statutes recognize that raising pets or raising animals for pets is an important part of agriculture, okay? And the people who are the closest to agriculture are the pet breeders, okay? But this bill covers only them, and it doesn't cover the other people that are selling pets. And the amount of appropriations that are in this bill would cover all of those, and so those people should be included. But my third and final point is that it's a bad investment for the state because spending $500,000 a year to do nothing more than current law to correct disease, parasites, and congenital defects to stop animal abuse and cruelty and neglect, which this bill does nothing to, it adds nothing to current law to do those things. Those are all being prosecuted currently under current law, and effectively under current law. This is absolutely not needed, and it's a waste of taxpayer funds.
Thank you, Lindy Forrester. We will have just a moment or two of testimony. We have one more bill that I think members we can get through and not come this evening. But on the other hand, I know you would like my company this evening. Welcome to the committee. If you could give your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Lindy Forrestatter. Thank you very much for your time. I'm looking over this fiscal note. It doesn't quite go where I had in mind. I just wanted to point out that some of the previous comments that pet breeders are not regulated around the state is not true. There are USDA regulations to inspect pet breeders with four or more females who ship one or more puppies or kittens. There's also 81 out of 87 counties have inspections. So this bill is actually a duplicative bill. It's not addressing a problem. There used to be a loophole that the USDA has closed. And basically spending any extra money on this problem when a specific breeder could be inspected by their city and the USDA and the American Kennel Club and now the state. It could be 3, 4, 5 inspections from different organizations, and it is a waste of money. And I think that we need to look at using money responsibly, and this is quite an expensive task. That's really not clear how much it's going to cost and how many people it's going to affect. I think it's based on a lot of guesswork, and I think you should rethink it. There are a lot of other concerns that were not addressed in the previous committees, such as co-owners going into who's affected by the bill and who's not, based on how many dogs they have that they co-own with other people. And so basically it's just a bad bill overall, and we really wish that it wasn't pushed so hard to only look at the financial aspect, because it is something that impacts a lot of small mom and pop organizations, and we feel like the money behind it with animal welfare organizations is pushing something that's just giving all of us more bureaucracy and a harder time to do our hobby or our small business.
Thank you. I don't see anybody else, so you may have 1 minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Julie Gertis, and I am a professional pet breeder, but I'm more here today to speak as a concerned Minnesota citizen, and I will limit it to the fiscal note. If you're going to pass this bill, I would like to see it be as self-funding as possible by raising the proposed licensing fee. I would like to suggest to have just one flat fee over the 16 possible fee structures that are established. From my experience, I've been a dog breeder for 25 years. I do not agree with the estimate of $475 that's proposed. As we've watched in other states that have instituted licensing, their estimates are extremely elevated. My expert estimate would be that there would be between 100 and 200 breeders that would fall under this category. Currently, the licensing fee is established at starting at $100, maxing out at $250. I actually would like to see that be a flat licensing fee of $1,000, so that this is more of a self-funded policy, so that it is not a burden on the Minnesota taxpayers. There's another change that I would like to recommend, and that is that the Breeder of Excellence portion be stricken from this bill. There was no specific cost analysis given to attach to that portion of this bill, number one, so I can't really evaluate whether that would be something that any of you would think was a good use of funds. However, I don't believe government should be instituting any kind of Breeder of Excellence program for any business. The American Kennel Club has a Breeder of Merit program. The American Canine Association has a five-star blue ribbon program. The Cat Fanciers Association has a Cattery of Excellence. So the dog and cat breeding industry really does not need this for them. So I'd like to see that removed. And that was it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I don't see anyone else, and I don't see any questions, so I renew my motion that House File 84, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Blesch. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I would move House File 2101 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and I have a A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. And I would move the A3 amendment.
This amendment came in this morning? Oh, okay. All right. It didn't quite meet the 24-hour rule, but it's only like minutes away from it. So I'm going to waive the rule. I have not heard any comments about it. And the Representative Hansen moves H2 A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any objection? Amendment is adopted. To the bill is amended. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think members of the committee are aware of the issue relating to small plastic microbeads in some cosmetics. The bill, as it was introduced, was requesting the Pollution Control Agency to look at sampling when they are out doing the water testing. I have Mr. Scuda here from the Pollution Control Agency to give a little background on the issue and Representative McNamara, instead of millions of dollars, this particular appropriation is $1,000. So we've been cutting back our requests.
Here we can become.
Mr. Scuda, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Glenn Scuda, the Surface Water Monitoring Manager for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and Representative Hansen indicated, just to give a little bit of background, plastic microbeads are very tiny plastic particles introduced into personal care products, a variety of products from toothpaste to cosmetics, soaps, cleansers, that type of thing, for their abrasive properties. And given the products they're in, either during or after use, they get washed down the drain, go to wastewater treatment plants. Because they're so small and because they float, they don't settle out in wastewater treatment plants, they don't filter out, so they're passing through them into the surface waters, the rivers of the state. So the concern there is once they enter the environment as a plastic, they don't really break down. They can be ingested by very small organisms in the food chain, can disrupt then the food chain by either starving those organisms by making them feel essentially full so they don't continue to eat, or clogging their digestive systems, and then can cause a problem at the lower levels of the food chain so that there's not food for the higher organisms. Also, potential for the plastics to absorb toxins that are in the water, things like PCBs that, again, when they're ingested by the organisms, can introduce those toxins into the food chain as well. So the bill, rather than requesting us to do some monitoring, which would be somewhat complicated because it's a different type of monitoring given the nature of the these floating plastic beads versus the typical kind of chemistry type monitoring we do, we're relying instead to follow up on work that's being done particularly in the state of New York, where they're really furthest along on this type of research. There's researchers at New York universities that have been studying the Great Lakes and also inland waters of New York. We feel that rather than duplicating their efforts, we can do a very inexpensive literature search of their work and whatever other information is available out there, compile that for your consideration in developing policy related to this.
Questions, members? Representative Banners.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned that these light beads wouldn't settle out. I can understand that, but you said they also wouldn't filter out because they were light. I don't quite understand why a filter wouldn't get them just because they were light.
Madam Chair, Representative, more so the filtering, just because they're so small. The particles are literally, if you can picture the size of Abraham Lincoln's eye on a penny, some of them are about that small. So they have been found in New York to be passing through the plants in wastewater effluent. So it's more about size.
Representative Torkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Representative Hansen, I'm curious about the $1,000 fiscal impact of this. I know we can probably hire legislators at $66 a day, but I'm curious what the $1,000 is going to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, this was the fiscal note that came from the agency on that, so I think that could be better directed to the agency on what the $1,000 means.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll redirect my question to the agency.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's just a cost estimate of the amount of staff time that it would take to compile the information. So we just looked at past studies that we've done for this body, and we feel that that's a good ballpark, that we can constrain it to that small amount and pull together the information.
I don't see any other questions. I don't see anybody from the audience getting up and raising their hand. So Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2101, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Mr. Scuda, members, I'm going to miss you tonight. We can do. We're going to do minutes. Who is going to do minutes for us?
I'll move the minutes of the
March 11th and March 13th meetings.
Thank you for doing that. Representative Freeberg moves the minutes of March 11th and 13th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any objection? Minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. We will not see you tonight, but we will see you on Thursday for a possibly very long day. Meeting's adjourned.